My name is Polly Botsford. Welcome to this podcast of the International Bar Association, recorded in London. I'm interviewing Martin Day, currently senior partner at Lee Day, a firm he co-founded to act for the most vulnerable in society in the UK and abroad. Martin relishes being the one to take on governments, mostly the British, and corporations. He hit the headlines in particular in the 2000s when he decided to represent Iraqis in claims against the British Army. "I really like a good fight," he has told the press, which is lucky because in 2014 he found that his own conduct and that of his firm was under attack from the press and then the regulator for the way they alleged he had managed the Iraq war claims. An enfant terrible indeed. He says things that no one else will say, and we hope that he will do that today on this podcast. Welcome, Martin.
Glad to be here.
I read that you said your mum described you as an active member of the awkward squad as a child. What drives you to be the one asking the awkward questions, to be the one in the room saying what no one else will say?
I enjoy the battle. I enjoy the fight. I enjoy the feeling that you're trying to make a bit of a difference in your life and trying to help people who are in more difficult situations. So, you know, for me, it has often been a battle against the tide.
If we move on to your work, before we kind of go to the Iraq war, as it were, but some of the work before all that was about corporate accountability and the list of people and corporations, rather, sorry, that you have crossed, include Trafigura and Shell and many others. And I remember very particularly the Shell case where you represented the Bodo community in Nigeria. They were fishermen in the mangrove creeks, and the area was polluted from oil spills, and Shell settled for $55 million, as I understand, and promised to clean up the area. But there must be so many of those cases. Can you think of one that you feel has made a real difference to people's lives?
Well, Bodo was a big case, and getting the community $55 million, I went back there about a year after the case had finished, and it was lovely to see the amount of new building. You know, people being wary that people would just spend the money, their clients would spend the money on drinking or, you know, other nefarious activities. But in fact, as far as I could tell, most of the money was spent on trying to improve the quality of their lives. So things like improve their houses, they were spending their money on education for their kids. And, you know, you just felt that the community was significantly improved by that. So I felt very proud by that. We had a case back in the 90s where we acted for, sorry, in the early 2000s, where we acted for some Kenyans who'd been injured whilst as a result of British Army using a big area of land in central Kenya for its practice manoeuvres. And there they use live weaponry. About 9% of live weaponry doesn't actually go off. And the local kids, the Maasai and the Samburu, would take their sheep and goats onto the land because there was no fences to stop them. And they would find these shiny shells and they'd whack it against a rock and blow off their arm and the legs and all that sort of stuff. And we acted for a really nice guy called Kapizi. And he had his arm and his leg blown off. And when we were acting for him, he said to me, he'd been, you know, this had happened to him when he was about 10. And he said throughout his adult life, he'd always been a burden on his family. And we got for him, I think, about £200,000, something like that, you know, over there, massive sum. And when I went to see him about two or three years later back in the area, he was there in his Land Rover. He said he got three wives. And he said he was having the time of his life. And suddenly he was no longer a burden on his family. He was the benefactor for the family, that his family were doing well. So it was really nice just again to see that, you know, we'd been able to lift somebody from this terrible poverty that he'd been in, this terrible feeling that he was a burden on everybody's lives, and suddenly that he'd actually, as a result of the compensation, being able to benefit his family quite significantly following that.
And what's it like to bring a case like that, though? How do you choose which case? How do you kind of cope with the responsibility and the pressure?
A number of different things. You know, for me, I tend never to take the same case twice. I've got a very low boredom threshold. So I pass to others, you know, if any kind of follow-on case comes on. Exactly. You know, I just move on. And I like the challenge. You know, I like the battle. I like the fight. So I like to take on a case that looks difficult. I like the, you know, obviously, we've got to, on balance, think we're going to win. But it's rare that you're thinking, well, this is 90% certainly going to win. But, you know, you certainly, you know, we wouldn't take on a case that was really hopeless. You know, certainly some very tough ones. We took on the Mau Mau case where this was a case about the Kenyan freedom fighters back in the 1950s. And when they first came to me, I came back with a case and met with a number of QCs, left-wing QCs, human rights QCs, and they nearly all turned me down. In fact, the one who was prepared to say yes was Keir Starmer. So that was a case where actually we thought the chance was pretty slim, but I just felt we had to do it. I thought morally we had to do it, so the firm backed me up. You know, thank goodness they did. But mostly it's about, I like the battle, I like to take on, you know, the big giants of British multinationals, and I like to act for people who are in a perilous state who could otherwise not get justice. So balancing all those things together, you know, the cases come in.
Do you have a kind of prima facie position that most governments and most corporations are pretty suspicious?
Well, I am clear that all corporations, they are driven by profit. I mean, that's their, you know, that's their goal anyway. I mean, it's not anything surprising. But the fact that they are there to make profit is such an overwhelming factor that they put out all these nice little statements about their corporate social responsibility. And you realize when it comes to it, it means very little. On the ground, whether you're in Nigeria or out in other parts of Africa, in South America, the Indian subcontinent, that actually, when they're far away from the prying eye of the media, that actually they just get on and ride roughshod over local people's rights in many, many instances. And so, you know, for me, calling them to account is quite a critical feature of our society. I think that's also true of British government, is that, you know, the terrible things that they did in Iraq, the terrible things they've done in Afghanistan, all lies in a pattern that you look about what happened in Northern Ireland, previous before that, what happened in places like Kenya with the Mau Mau. You know, you see actually that there are difficult parts of our past that, you know, are clearly there. We can't ignore them. We can't do as a number of people say, we're just, let's just say bygones are bygones and move on. But actually, they've often left a legacy in parts of the world that we will never actually recover from until we've understood it and in some way provided justice for those people.
Well, on that point then, when we'll talk about Iraq War, it's a good moment to talk about it. So let's just recap on what the Iraq War claims were very specifically. So the claims arose out of an ambush by an insurgent group, the Mahdi Army. British soldiers engaged in the battle, which was subsequently referred to as Danny Boy. A number of Iraqis were killed, and out of that come claims against the MOD, Bright Boy, your firm, and Phil Shiner's firm, Public Interest Lawyers, known as the Al-Sweedy claims, that Iraqis were tortured, and I'm just using, simplifying and summarising, tortured by British soldiers. But alongside that, there were obviously so much else going on legally. We had the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, government public inquiries, and a huge number of claims against the MOD. But I suppose what happened for you personally and for Lee Day was that your decision to represent these detainees resulted in vilification. And you've been described by the press as unscrupulous, witch hunters, tank chasing, rather than ambulance chasing. When I had a quick look at your website, actually, I did notice that those claims weren't something that you kind of highlighted in your kind of profile. That's not because you regret bringing those claims, is it? Or
no, not for a single second. Is that in the end, there was a judge who was put in charge of these cases, all the individual complaints, called Leggett. And Mr. Justice Leggett at one stage said, well, actually access to justice in Iraq in terms of bringing cases about what the British did was basically access to Lee Day, because we were the only firm who were prepared to actually get out there and do these cases. So, you know, you recognise that bringing these sorts of cases are going to bring the might of the Mail and the Sun, as well as the Conservative government. They're going to bring it all against you. The British Army, you know, that is simply the way it is.
I mean, it doesn't faze you.
Well, it is tough. You know, it is tough. But it's the battle. And, you know, I think for our society, it'd be very, very sad if firms were not prepared to take that course. And certainly for me, you know, it's been tough. You know, there's no question about it being tough.
And when you say tough, what do you mean?
Well, it's a tough battle, you know, to have yourself slagged off in the, you know, in the newspaper.
How do you feel when you read it?
Well, I'm not that worried personally, but I know for the, you know, that people go home and their mums and their dads who read the Sun in the Mail think, you know, oh my God, what's the firm up to at the moment? You know, so, you know, you want your staff to feel proud about what they do and all that. So it's not always easy, but it's, you know, but the battle is there to be fought. And, you know, it was fundamentally right. There were undoubtedly mistakes that we made along the way at times, but then that would be true in any case that we do, probably anybody ever does. But fundamentally, it was right. And holding the British Army to account, holding the military generally to account is absolutely crucial if we are to have a free society. It's very important that one is clear that we never bring cases to do with the actual what happens on the battle itself. You know, is the courts have made it absolutely clear, and quite rightly, I've got no objection at all, that in the middle of a war, in the middle of a battle, you cannot expect soldiers to be thinking, oh, well, what's the Human Rights Act say about this? So totally accept that, and we do not bring cases, except the only case we've actually brought up on behalf of British soldiers' families, where people, where soldiers have been sent into battle without the proper equipment.
Yeah.
So, but that's obviously very different to what we're talking about here in terms of Iraqi claims. So all the claims to do with the Iraqis are what happens once the battle is finished and how British military then treat the people who've been detained.
But even if there's an ambush then, that wouldn't kind of count as a battle scene, as it were?
Well, there's been the odd case where, you know, terrible things have happened during, you know, whether it's an ambush or whether you've got a soldier who just goes berserk and starts shooting at people. So I'm not saying in any instance, but in terms of a proper battle where things are properly done, then there is no issue for the soldiers to have to worry. It is what happens once the people are in your custody. That is the crucial question. And there, any modern soldier in our army has got to accept that once you are in control of somebody, then they have freedom, they have human rights, they have the right to be treated in a respectful manner. And that's the, you know, what is the purpose of us going to war in Iraq or whatever if it isn't to bring about justice and human rights and democracy? Once you've passed the fog of war, once we actually have got people into custody, then the fact that we killed Baha Moussa, the fact that we've had time after time abuse, beatings, you know, the most appalling way, isn't, you know, is something we've got to learn from. It's to say, well, look, we do have significant numbers of people in our armies who do not act in the way that we would feel as a British nation is appropriate. And you can't just hide that.
Michael Fallon steps in as Defence Secretary and reports your firm to the regulator, the Solicitors Regulation Authority. And it's professional misconduct for the way that those claims have been handled. I won't trawl over them, but there were 19 allegations. And for the record, you were cleared of all allegations. But what was it like to be in a 7-week trial, to be on the receiving end, perhaps, of some of that scrutiny that perhaps you've carried out on others?
It was very interesting for me in terms of what I now say to people who are under cross-examination, having had to go through that for 4 days myself, say, look, you've got to be as prepared as the QC. You've got to put as much time as the QC will in to attack you. You've got to be making sure you defend. Do not go in there assuming that it will all come back to you. You've really got to go through every single letter, every email, just to remind yourself what had actually happened. So that was a massive lesson for me. But I think most importantly for me was that initially when the kind of complaints came in, you kind of immediately said, well, I certainly immediately said to myself, oh my God, have I made the most enormous muck up here? When I had a chance then to kind of go through it all, increasingly I felt, no, I hadn't. I've made the odd mistake, but they were, you know, they were just normal mistakes that you make in, you know, decisions you make at the time of the best will, but actually you realise later on were not good decisions. But that's very different to misconduct. And there wasn't a single thing that I felt we'd done wrongly. Now, once I was clear about that, I felt fine in myself. You know, the crucial thing to me is that had I done something, it certainly wasn't with me to say I wasn't carrying some element of guilt in myself that, you know, I'd realise I made some horrendous mistake, which could be misconduct, and then, oh my God, I've been found out. That certainly wasn't the case. Actually, the biggest issue for me is it takes your eye off the ball from the firm. You know, for about 2 years, it was, you know, probably 50% of my focus, you know. And I love my cases, you know. I absolutely love being a lawyer. I love the work that we do. So to be deflected of that for 2 years was the greatest annoyance, really, in terms of what happened. We are very unusual, very, you know, there are not many leaders around, not just in this country, but internationally. So I feel our primary role is to be out there to bring these cases, bring it to the attention of the world through the media here in the UK. They see what's going on, and then hopefully lessons will be learned to actually encourage local societies to take up the sort of law that we have in the UK or in the States or Canada or wherever, and allow these cases to be brought locally.
And to also, I suppose, which goes back to your good fight position, which is to present the fact that, you know, you can challenge authority, just a simple fact, which perhaps people don't necessarily have the courage to do.
In about 2010, I got an email from a Nigerian fisherman. And the email said, "Dear Mr. Day, I'm just a little local fisherman. My life is spent fishing, but I can no longer fish because there is oil in the water and I can not provide for my kids anymore." That one email brought about a £55 million resolution with Shell. So the idea of giving the power to that one individual, giving the power to the people, not just the Bodo, but in the Ivory Coast, in Zambia, and wherever it may be, but to provide them with the power, and it goes back to the point we made with discussing earlier, that in the end, these are the cases of the individuals. They're not my cases. They are the cases brought by these individuals. And my job is to give them the power, to give them the wherewithal that they can take on the might of the biggest multinationals in the world and win.
Fantastic. Martin Day, thank you very much indeed for joining us here at the International Bar Association. And we wait with bated breath to what happens next.
My pleasure.